And now, it gives me great pleasure to introduce our speaker for this morning, Mr. Matthew M. from Santa Paula, California. Matthew, it's all yours.
Hey, Todd, thank you. Give me just a second to take my face off speaker view so I don't have to stare at myself while I do this. Hey, my name is Matthew, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm really grateful that I was asked to come do this. Thank you, Taryn, for chasing me down, and Debbie for reminding me. And Todd, thank you today for introducing me to Jannie. And really been trying to just stay awake and focused on what everything that's happening here. I have to say that for the first time, Gretchen, when she read more about alcoholism, it said something that landed on me funny this time. It said, you know, we were trying to prove we could drink like other people. And I thought to myself, I've never tried to prove that. I tried to find people that drank like me, but I never was trying to drink like anybody else. I mean, that seemed like a waste of my time. My sobriety date is May 16th, 1993. And my home group is the Hermosa Beach Monday Night Men's Stag. I want to start with today, actually. I woke up this morning around 6 and I made a cup of coffee for my wife of 25 years. And I went out and meditated for half an hour in my office where I'm sitting right now. And then I had a scheduled call with an AA friend, and we talked for over an hour. And then I went in and talked to my wife for a while, and she helped me pick out this coat and tie. And I took my dogs outside and I fed them. And the paycheck that I got on Friday is still completely 100% in the bank. And I didn't lie to anyone. It's 10 o'clock in the morning and I haven't lied to anyone. And I've been up for 4 hours. So these are all things that I just think it's sometimes we need to stop and say, what does recovery look like? You know, I'm 27 years sober. I'm not still sick. I don't belong to that club that says I'm sick. I'm in recovery. My life is transformed incredibly. And I think the thing that Alcoholics Anonymous gave me that I've realized over all these years of staying very close to AA is some relief from the bondage of self. And I'll tell you, my first drink was kind of late. You know, actually there's someone on this call who's known me since I was in first grade. But my first drink was late in high school. I think it was my junior or senior year. And I actually just found a picture of a bunch of high school friends. And when I looked at that picture, I remembered my brother was homeless then, my alcoholic brother. My parents were not alcoholics. My uncles died of alcoholism. My grandfather died of alcoholism. In fact, my father told me on his deathbed that Bill Wilson came to their house and tried to help my grandfather, Cornelius Mitchell, in 1942, I think. And my grandfather died from liver failure in 1945. But I didn't have, you know, I had this brother who was out causing havoc and messing up our family life. And I felt alone. I felt like no one understood me in high school, which I look back and think, you know, I was playing in a great rock and roll band. I was dating the head cheerleader. I was getting straight A's. And I think, God, I wish I knew what everybody else knew. I don't know why I thought like that, but my first drink was at a guy named Casey Kerwin's house in Hermosa Beach. And he had a big house. He had 8 brothers and sisters and everybody was gone. And my 5 friends from the small Catholic school I went to were there and they were drinking tequila. And I wasn't drinking because my brother was homeless, you know, and my family had been hurt by this. And I didn't want to repeat that. And I didn't want to hurt my parents. But I had all this angst in me. I felt like I had acne from the top of my head to the bottom of my feet. I was really skinny. They were all good athletes. I was a terrible athlete. That's why I played guitar, actually. And my mom asked me if I got picked first for the team. And I said no. And she bought me a guitar. Changed the whole my whole life. Anyway, they're all standing around drinking tequila, these 5 guys and me at this beautiful house overlooking the ocean in Hermosa Beach. And finally, I just said, you know, I'll have a drink of that. Because my feeling of inferiority and my aloneness and the treachery of living with my own thinking just was too much. And they said, well, you know, Mitch, this is tequila. They were like, be careful. And I didn't know what that meant. And I took a shot of tequila. And I love talking about this with you people because only you understand. You know, I took that shot of tequila and it hit my chest and 12 years of Catholic school guilt melted out of my shoulders. You know, suddenly I could throw a ball. I felt like I was funny and smart, and it was amazing. It was amazing. So I went and I got a big glass, and I came and asked for more tequila, and they warned me, it's tequila, be careful. And about an hour later, I walked down to the bathroom, and it's this big house, and I felt like I was on a cruise ship. You know, it's just moving around now, and it had been stationary for most of my life, and now it's moving. And I walk down the hall, and I go into the bathroom, and I sit down in the toilet, and I remember thinking, before I blacked out, that God would not make my body so that I could defecate and vomit at the same time. And as the room began to spin, because Sister Dennis Ann told me, God, you're perfect. God is perfect. And I passed out, and I was in the midst of both of those functions. I blacked out, and I woke up in the morning, and I was on the floor of the bathroom in a sleeping bag. It was very clean in there. My five friends had found me in between functions and cleaned me up and put me in there. And I was mortified. I thought, God, I don't want to be like my brother. I didn't know why I was in the bathroom in a sleeping bag. I didn't remember what had happened. And, you know, I hear people in AA conferences and at AA meetings say things like, I got drunk. I got in a fight. I got beat up. I threw up all over the place and I couldn't wait to do it again. And I wasn't like that. I woke up and thought, I don't want to be my brother. I don't want to be my brother. I didn't even know my grandfather was an alcoholic because we never talked to him. But I don't want to be my brother. And I didn't drink again right then. And the reason I bring this up at this convention is there's 556 people on here right now. And I think there are probably people in their first week of sobriety. And there's probably people in their first 6 months of sobriety. And there's probably people in their first year of sobriety. And sometimes we just talk about what it was like how bad it got. And I want to remind everybody or tell my story is that it was a slow, ugly progression of alcoholism. I had it made. I had two parents that loved each other. They worked really hard so I could go to this school. They sent me to college. I had two brothers and a sister that really loved me. I had talent. I'm a talented musician and songwriter. I had a lot of things going for me. And I didn't start out like a bum that I ended up. I went off to college. I graduated with two degrees at the top of my class. I have a degree in religious studies and a degree in English. And I formed a great band there. And I, towards the end of college, I started missing a few things and turning in papers late. And then I went on the road with a band for 12 years. And, you know, just to tell you what my alcoholism was like, I got kicked out of a rock and roll band, a successful rock and roll band, for drinking too much. You know, and I joke about it now, like, you know, that's really hard to do, but I drank my dream away. I drank my dream away. And it was like this. I'd have a drink and I'd think, you know, don't go with the fun people. Get back on the bus. You have to go to the next town. Don't go off with the fun people. And I'd go off with the fun people. And what all I know is by May of 1993 that had happened is the long, slow progression of alcoholism had taken me from being a fairly decent human being. If I was your boyfriend in college, I was amazingly true to you. I was seriously monogamous. I wrote songs for you. I surprised you with flowers. If I worked for you, I was one of your best employees. I always was promoted to manager, always, even in these little jobs I got in college. In school, I tried really hard. I was a really good friend. I'd show up for you. But after the long, slow, ugly progression of alcoholism in May of 1993, I live on Avenue A in South Catalina, a block from the ocean. I haven't left my apartment except to go next door to the liquor store. And for about 6 months, I'd been fired from the last job that was beneath me. You remember that? When you get fired from the job that you thought was too lame for you to do in the first place. That's what happened to me. Is I got this job as a waiter after I got fired from the music business. And then I got promoted to manager. And then I got fired because all I did was drink up the profits. I rarely showed up on time. I didn't manage people very well. And I got fired. And on my way out the door of getting fired, I was 31 years old. And one of the 18-year-old waitresses said, I'm pregnant. And it's terrible to say, but my job here today is to be honest about who I was. And if you had lined up the waitresses at Marie Callender's in Homocha Beach and said, which one do you want to get pregnant? I would have said, not her. And it's terrible to say, but I want to tell you who I was. My belief at 31 years old, having made a complete mess of my life, is that she was too selfish and self-centered to have a baby. She was ruining my life. So that's just who I was. I at that point, after the slow, ugly progression of alcoholism, I took a bus home because I couldn't find my car. And I sat in my apartment and tried to drink myself to death. 2 miles away, my mother's dying of cancer. I can't go see her. I can't seem to get up enough gumption to get out the door. I call her and say I was going to come see her. I owe tens of thousands of dollars to people. I have warrants out for my arrest. I haven't paid my rent in my apartment, and I keep holding my breath when anybody comes up on the porch. But that's not why I'm here to speak at a convention. If you're new in sobriety, if you're in your first year of sobriety, none of that moonscape that I had made out of my life is why I'm qualified to speak at an Alcoholics Anonymous convention. The reason I'm qualified to be here is I woke up every day of that 6 months and said to myself, don't drink today. Because I didn't want to drink. The distance between the drink and the trouble had evaporated. It was gone. I was completely and utterly in the bondage of self, meaning all I could think about was me. I often forgot that that girl was pregnant across town because I was sitting in my apartment drinking myself into oblivion. And what makes me available and eligible to speak here is I would wake up and say, don't drink today. And then I'd think, get a job today. Do your laundry today. Go see your mother today. Go see that girl's parents and tell them you're going to be a stand-up guy. Be a good man like you've always been. Pull this out of the dive it's in like you've always done. And I didn't know then, but I know now that when I woke up and said, don't drink today, I might as well have said, Matthew, hold back the Pacific Ocean today because I have a disease. And the way my disease manifests is an obsession of the mind. And one of the things that I can give you an example of that, it's just sort of a run-of-the-mill day. If I got in the shower after telling myself, don't drink, get a job, go see your mother. If I got in the shower, which I didn't do every day, there was no reason to. I never left the house. And that hot water would hit my face. And I'd think, you know, it's not so bad. And then I'd think, if I got a couple of beers next door, not a bottle of gin, but a couple of beers, I'd probably go see mom. Because part of the reason I wasn't going to go see my mom is I didn't know if she knew I was fired from my job or that I had a pregnant girlfriend or that any of the other stuff. But if I have a couple beers, I'll probably calm down, go see my mom. And I believed that. But once, I don't know about you, but once I thought in any positive way about alcohol, once that thought slipped under my resolution, my door of I'm not going to drink. Once that happened, I knew I was going to drink. And once I know I'm going to drink, I have a whole different attitude. And I'd go next door to that liquor store and I'd have enough money to buy 2 big Fosters, or I could buy a fifth of gin. And why am I going to buy the Fosters? Because that's not really, you know, that's great to go see mom, but I'm going to come home from seeing mom. And I'm going to want to have something else to drink. And this is how my mind's going. And it seems perfectly legitimate to me. And I would go in there and buy the gin. And I'd go home and I think I'll just have a little. And then I'd never go see my mom. And I want to tell you, I don't want to belabor this, but I want to tell you, those were good people, my mother and my father. My mother loved my dad. And my mother was a quiet, observant woman. Like I said, she watched me at school and said, you don't get picked first with a team. And she bought me a guitar because I said, I want to play guitar so badly, mom. And right now she'd be so proud of me. There's like 9 guitars laying around this office. And she said, you know, I'm going to help you out. And my father was this lovely man. He was boisterous and funny and Irish guy. And he loved my mother. And he always spoke with respect about my mother. They taught me character. They taught me self-respect. They taught me how to treat people. And when that pregnant 18-year-old girl was 8 and a half months pregnant on May 1st of 1993, I threw her down a flight of stairs. And I didn't want to hurt her. Why would I want to hurt her? I didn't want to hurt that baby. I've never hurt anyone. I've never even gotten in a fight. But she wanted me to stop drinking that day. We had to go to the doctor, she said. And I thought she was screaming at me that I was a bum. And I just pushed her a little, you know, to get her out of the doorway. But then I knew I pushed her too hard. I hadn't seen her in a couple months. And I slammed the door shut when I saw the fear on her face as she fell backwards down the stairs. That's who I became. I was born with everything you could ever want. Love. I had so much love. We didn't have a lot of money, but we had so much love and direction and good examples. But the slow, ugly progression of alcoholism works like this. My friend Beth once said to me, if alcohol took everything that you loved in your life in one day, everyone who drank it would go to AA and get sober. But alcohol doesn't do that. It takes a little bite and you adjust down. And it takes another bite and you adjust down. And pretty soon you're living in squalor and you don't even know it. You know, I did find people that drank like I did. They lived in squalor too. So there was a lot of forgiveness and a lot of baffles. We kept our eyes on what we wanted to do, not what we were living like, until I didn't want to be around them anymore, or until they didn't want to be around me, or until we'd ripped each other off enough that there was nothing left. And I'm sitting in this apartment listening at night to this weird noise, and I don't know what it is, and it's the ocean, and I haven't seen it in 7 months, and it's right outside my back door. So that's what I was like. That's what happened after years of drinking. And fortunately, I was 31. It wasn't as long. I will admit, my bottom was accelerated by drug use, but I'm fully and completely an alcoholic from day one. Once I drink, I want more. And no matter what the problem. So that's what I was like. So what happened to me? Well, I know today, and I didn't know it then, but I worked the first step on May 9th of 1993. I got sober May 16th. But I did my first surrender on May 9th. And what happened was my brother, who was sober for 12 years now in AA at that time, called me and he said, tomorrow's Mother's Day. And it's probably mom's last Mother's Day. And we want to make sure you're going to show up. And immediately I'm like, why would he think I'm not going to show up? Like, I'm indignant. You know that arrogance of alcoholism? I kind of forgot that I called almost every day and said, I'm going to come over. And I never went over. I do remember that my mother would say the same thing. My mother was a very wise and loving woman. And I would call and say, I'm going to come over, Mom. And I meant it. I totally meant it. And she would say, that would be lovely, darling. She didn't say you called yesterday. She lived with alcoholism before. She just said that would be lovely. And they really didn't know what was going on with me. But my brother called and said, I know you're having car trouble. Remember, we're Irish. I can't find my car. We consider that car trouble in an Irish family. We're very like forgiving about that kind of stuff. It's like, I know you're having car trouble, so I'll come by tomorrow, right? And I thought, well, I am. I have this key to this AMC, which was, you know, the AMC wasn't that great when I knew where it was. And he said, I'll come pick you up, because I want to make sure you're going to be there. And I got off the phone and I just wanted to make my mom's Mother's Day amazing. I'm going to take a shower. I'm going to do my laundry. I'm going to get some flowers. I'm going to write a card. I can write a great card. I have a degree in English. I'm ready. And I sat down on the couch and I poured a little bit of gin to organize my plan. And he honked his horn. Whatever, 15 hours later. And I've been sitting there drinking. Probably, I'm guessing, drinking, falling asleep. And occasionally, it's so humiliating. I'd go outside after the liquor store closed and pick up all the cigarette butts and then roll myself cigarettes and sit and drink and sit and drink. And he honked his horn. I smell. I haven't changed my clothes in 3 days. I'm so dirty. My hair is stuck to my head with oil from my oily hair. And I look around. I see him outside through the Venetian blinds. And I'm stunned and startled and freaked out. And so I ran down the hall and tried to put a decent looking shirt on, a dirty shirt. And I ran outside. Now, I don't know it, but I weigh 108 pounds at that time. I didn't know that. I weigh 170 pounds right now. And I'm exactly the same height. Actually, I think I'm a little shorter. That was a long time ago. But I went outside to the car and he looked at me and he looked so surprised. And I didn't know why, but that didn't add to my son's confidence. I just thought, oh God, you know. And I went down and I ruined Mother's Day. I just ruined it. And I don't even really know what I did. I just remember their faces. And my sister is my best friend now, and she's 12 years older than me. And I called her on my 20th AA birthday 7 years ago. And I said, hey, what happened on Mother's Day? And she said, you know, darling, we're never going to speak about that. I said, what do you mean? And she goes, I just don't think we ever need to talk about that. You were vile to our mother. Now, I don't think I can tell you enough how much I love that woman, how much respect I have for Dorothy Lyon Mitchell, what she did for me in my life, how much she cared about me. I never had that angst with my parents. I didn't fight with my parents. I loved them. And she said, you were vile. So whatever I did, I was completely inappropriate. And my brother took me home. This is May 9th. And he took me home and he dropped me off and we were arguing all the way home. And I just had a feeling I couldn't let this go. I couldn't be yelled at again by my older brother. And I love my arrogance. I love my self-righteousness. I'm living like Gollum in an apartment by the beach. Oh, my precious. You know, I'm laying on the couch watching TV for 6 months, getting drunk, playing my guitar, selling my guitars. My brother is sober 12 years. When he says he's going to go see my mom, he goes and sees my mom. My brother is so obnoxiously sober. He bought a house that had 12 steps to the front door. I mean, what do you do with that guy? I mean, who, you know, so, but I honestly, I didn't even know I was an alcoholic. I honestly didn't. I just was struggling really hard and I couldn't seem to not pull it out, but I'm mad at my brother. I think I have the moral higher ground. And I'll say to you, if you're new, even if you're not new, it's my experience that we rarely know what's going to set the ball of grace in motion. We rarely know that thing that's going to make grace come rushing to us. But I can tell you one of the things for sure is you have to surrender just a little to get the grace. And my brother, I called my brother, I screamed at him. Like, let him have it, whatever I was saying about being his little brother all my life. I don't know. And he listened. He didn't say a word. I just yelled and yelled. And when it was finally quiet, he very quietly said into the phone, Matthew, I think you have a problem with alcoholism. And I surprised myself when out of my mouth came, of course I do. I didn't think I was going to say that. I didn't know that I just worked the first step. I admitted I was powerless. I didn't know I worked the first step. All you had to do was look around my apartment to see how unmanageable my life was. I used to make collages late at night with magazine pictures. It's a whole nother story. I don't want to get into that. But they were all over the floor. There were gin bottles all over the floor. And I remember this because when I said, of course I do to him into the phone. The phone was a beige phone. It had a cord that went to the phone on the floor. There was green shag carpet. There were gin bottles everywhere. There were pictures from magazines and X-Acto knives and junk on the floor. And I could see the little slats of sunlight through the Venetian blinds and the dust going in that sunlight. And I was right there. And I think the reason I have that memory so carefully seared into me isn't because I worked the first step. It's because just for a second, I stepped into the present moment and could feel everything that was happening. Just for 1 second. And I hadn't been there in years. And like I said, you surrender and grace. Surrender. I just said, yeah, I do. I must. I am an alcoholic. And he said, don't go anywhere, which I think is so funny. I'm like, oh, okay. I was going to move to that end of the couch in October, but if you don't want me to go anywhere, I'll just stay right here, you know. And he raced to my apartment. And when he got to my apartment, he ran in and I was sitting there waiting for him to come in and start yelling at me, telling me I ruined Mother's Day and I'm a lazy person and he's going to hurt me. And he was a physical guy when we were kids. And he came in, he looked around and he said, let's go to the beach. And he took me out of that terrible, disgusting environment that I had built for myself as alcoholism took bites. And he took me down to the beach and we sat on this lifeguard stand. In fact, somebody just sent me a picture yesterday of the lifeguard stand. It's right over there. that he did this. We sat on the lifeguard stand and my brother started telling me how he felt when my parents threw him out of his house. And I was surprised because I was waiting to get screamed at. And I listened a little because I remember that day when he got thrown out of our house. I was 11 years old and I couldn't believe we did that to one of our own. My brother's 7 years older than me. And he started telling me about how he felt when his wife and son threw him out of their house. And I remember I was about 14 or 15 because he called me that day. And my brother was cool. My brother looked like Paul McCartney, played the drums. He was very smart. And he told me I felt that day. And I remember because he called me. And I remember saying to him when I was 14, maybe you shouldn't drink. And he said, you don't understand. And I didn't understand because I hadn't had that shot of tequila yet. And then he told me how he felt when he lived in his car. I hated that time. Because I would get up in the morning sometimes and I'd tell my dad, hey, I got band practice after school. Can I take my Stratocaster and my Fender Twin in your car to school? And then I'll come back. And so I'd have to get up super early, drive my instruments to the car, to the music room. Then, and that's, I was a trustworthy kid. I had the keys to the music room. I'd go in there, set my stuff up, drive back. And then my dad would drive to work. Well, I got up half an hour earlier than that. And I'd drive around looking for my brother. Sometimes he'd be parked behind the YMCA. Sometimes he'd be parked down by the beach. He had a big gray, a primer gray Cadillac with fins. And if he was in the car, he was asleep. I'd look in, he'd be passed out. I just know he was alive. And if he wasn't in the car, I just left a note. And my brother's telling me how he felt during that part of his life. And I remember how, what a hole I felt in me that night at Casey's house when I took that tequila, because I couldn't believe it. Like we were letting somebody die like a dog in our family. And I was so curious and interested in what he was saying that I lost all my defenses. And I realized he was really describing how I felt sitting on that lifeguard stand. And for a long time, I thought my brother was a genius. And then I read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and the chapter Working with Others. And it says, tell them a little bit of your own story and win their confidence. And he knew enough to treat me like an alcoholic and not like his little brother. And he saved my life. Now, I told you I worked my first step that day, but I didn't get sober for a while, for 6-7 days. And he said, I'll be back. I got to figure. Oh, first I said, you're right. Like halfway through this conversation, I'm smoking these cigarettes like they're candy. And I said, hey, you're right. I'll go to AA. Because he was clear-eyed and honest. And I didn't know how to get over there. I wanted to every day. And I said, okay. I'll go to AA. And he goes, man, you're not going to AA. You're going to a hospital. And I looked him right in the eye and said, I don't think I can do that. I'm busy. I'm way too busy for the hospital, man. Don't you understand? Like, who's not going to pay my bills? You know, I'm the guy who doesn't pay those bills. I got stuff to not do right now. I can't come to the hospital. And anybody else? Too busy for rehab? Yeah, there you are. I knew Deb was. But anyway, I just went back to drinking. He's going to come in a few days and get me. And I'll tell you for what happened, and then I'll get into recovery because I got good time to tell you about that. I stayed up all night drinking May 15th because he said he was coming on the 16th to take me. And I passed out and hit my head on the wall. I remember that because I woke up with my neck against the wall and I had a big lump on my head and I landed on a Big Gulp from 7-Eleven, which is the mystery Big Gulp because I didn't live anywhere near a 7-Eleven and I never left my house, but there it was. So I've passed out on it. Anybody else have mystery stuff in their house? Like the next day, you're like, where'd that come from? And so I'm laying on this, I feel sticky and gross and the phone rings and I think it's him. So I pick up the phone and it's this woman. I met her. God, 20 years later, I never knew who it was, but she said, hey, your daughter was born today. We've been looking all over for you. And what that means is they've been calling that number, but I don't answer that phone. I particularly don't answer that phone if I'm drinking. People want to hurt me. I don't want to get them close to me. And she said, can you come to the hospital? And I said, yeah, man. And I stood up from all night drinking. I got a Coke dripping down my back. I got a lump in my head. I got a t-shirt on with a hole in it. I'm wearing OR scrubs because I don't know why. And I had flip-flops that were by the door. So I ran off into the sunlight and it was punishing it was very bright. I had a terrible hangover and I had my car key and I found that car. I walked around and around that neighborhood and it was covered with parking tickets. And if anybody's familiar with Redondo Beach, it's a stroke of grace that it wasn't towed away or booted. It had a ton of parking tickets on it in 1993. And I threw them in the back of my car and I raced to the hospital where I was born because I'm selfish and self-centered and they weren't there. They were never going to be there. That's just where babies come from in my mind because that's where I was born. And I had a moment of clarity walking back to my car. I had a moment of clarity knowing what a loser I was. What a disgusting pig I was. I can't even find them. I got this lame car. I'm supposed to go to rehab. I'm terrified about that. So I made the decision to go home and shoot myself. I had a gun and a bullet, one bullet. I was afraid of guns. And I was going to go home and put this gun in my mouth. And I got in the car and I put my head on the steering wheel and I turned the ignition and the car popped because it had backfired. And my head bounced off the steering wheel and the name of the hospital came into my brain. Now, if you're new, I got to explain that to you. That is called grace. And it comes from a power greater than me. And the reason I know that is I meditate a lot. I meditate a half an hour twice a day. I have for 15 years. And I know the way my mind works. I don't pick my thoughts. And what I was trying to do when I turned that car on was get enough courage to really pull the trigger when I got back to my apartment. And out of the blue, the name of a hospital comes into my head. That is grace. And if you're here right now, you have had it. If you're in this room, even if you're not sober and you're in this room, or if you're lying about your sobriety date and you're in this room, you've had so many moments of that grace, so much of it, and you just don't even know it. And I drove to the right hospital. I didn't go shoot myself. And I ran up the stairs to meet that baby. And I ran down the hall and I turned in and I was not thinking. I had not prepared myself. And there's Anna. And I forgot the last time I saw Anna and the look of terror on her face. And I ran in there and she just had a baby. So she looked terrible. I mean, her hair was matted to her head. She looked a little like the Elephant Man. I mean, I don't know if you've ever seen anyone that's just had a baby. They look terrible, but she's coming at me and she's glad to see me. And she looks so beautiful. And I don't know why. Her physical appearance looks like she got hit by a truck, but there's something about her that was so present and alive, and it made me feel disgusted. And she came up to this little box in the room. I thought she was gonna hug me and I smelled bad and I didn't want her to hug me and she didn't. She picked up this little bundle out of this box and she handed me Phoebe Rose. And Phoebe Rose was stunning and she repulsed me because I've never felt uglier in my life. I've never felt more disgusting, never since or ever before. Then I felt that morning holding that baby, looking at Anna and wondering, why can't I live on the planet they live on where people are good? And I knew I was going to hurt them. I could see what was happening. And I lied and I said, everything's going to be all right. And in the back of my mind, I thought, I'm really going to pull the trigger when I get home. I cannot unleash me on these two beauties. And I got to tell you, I'm not trying to make friends here. I didn't even like Anna, but there was something amazing about her. And I left and I wanted to go home and die. And I prayed all the way home, Dad, God, make it so that I never see them again. Please make it so that I never see them again because I'm going to hurt them. And I got home and I ran up my stairs and my brother standing at the top of my stairs. It's called grace. It's everywhere. It's always out there. If my brother weren't standing there, I wouldn't be here today. And I said, I need to go inside. He said, no, you don't. I said, I need to go inside. He said, no, you don't. I packed your stuff, get in the car. And my sponsor, Bill C. of the Hermosa Beach Monday Night Magnet Stag, he says the most spiritual sentence in Alcoholics Anonymous is get in the car. And I did. I didn't really have a choice. He's my older brother, but I got in the car and I went off to rehab. And in rehab, all I remember, it was a really great rehab. And what I remember of it is I gained 47 pounds. I don't remember anything else. I don't really remember. I mean, I was a little noisy inside my head, but they got me healthy. And they got me to some meetings and they did some other stuff. And on the day I got out, so that's what it was like, or what I was like, that's what happened. And then the day I got out, my brother drove me home and he said, go to a meeting. And I lie reflexively. And I said, yeah, that's what I was going to do. And I'm not going to a meeting, man. In fact, I thought when he said that, UAA guys are a little intense, man. I've just been in a hospital for 30 days. I got a terminally ill mother. I have a baby I need to visit. I got an apartment that I got to pretty much clean out. I didn't even know what drugs are in there. I know there's no booze in there because I drank it all. I don't know what's going on. I got lots to do, but yeah, I'll go to a meeting. I just lied. And I walked into that room, my apartment, the door was unlocked. That kind of surprised me. And I walked in and somebody handed me a beer. It wasn't a beer, it was a Coors. So I was probably safe, but they put this beer in my hand and there were girls snorting cocaine off the glass table. And there were guys smoking pot and there was really loud music. And I just from 1 second of scanning the room, I could see most things of value were gone. And my lower companions had found out I'd gone to rehab. I got a beer in my hand and I'm just out of rehab. Now, if you're in your first 6 months, I want to tell you two things. One is I turned around and ran out of that apartment. And I want to tell you why. It was not because I had a foundation of recovery. I did not have a connection to a higher power brought about by the steps. I didn't have that. But I had a moment of grace. And what happened was I looked at this party and the beer in my hand. And the first thought I had is, Matthew, you have nothing. You have nothing. You don't have character. You don't have self-respect. There's like two people left on earth that love you. You don't have your instruments. You don't have any prospects. You're a dad and you have no way to make a living. But you got 30 days. That was loud and clear that the only thing I had that I could hang my hat on was 30 days of recovery. And my second thought was, are you going to throw it away on these losers again, the fun people? And I backed out and put that beer down and I ran. I didn't walk away. I ran away. In fact, I ran about 4 blocks and I got to a payphone. That payphone's not there anymore. And there's young people. There was a phone booth. There's young people on the call. They're rectangular and they're made out of glass. And they have these little weird doors that are on spaceships. And they have these phones that are the size of nuclear warheads in them. And you look it up, Google it. But I went into one of those and And this is, again, I can't believe the grace, but I'm looking for AA in the phone book, you know, Mr. 2 Degrees. And I finally found it. And I call AA and I tell him how screwed up I am, how afraid I am, how unique I am, how my problems are different than anybody else's problems in AA. And I really need help. And the guy said, hold on, man, where are you? And I said, I'm in the corner of Burl and Redondo Beach Boulevard. And he said, okay, hold on a second. And I heard him flipping through some papers. And he said, hey, there's a meeting right across the street from where you're standing. And it starts in 15 minutes. It's everywhere. Grace is everywhere. And all I had to do was get a little relief from the bondage of self and say 37 days before that, of course I'm an alcoholic. That's all I needed to do to set that in motion. And I actually said to the guy when he said there's a meeting right across the street, I said, what do you think I should do? Because that was a little intimidating. I wanted some little gentler way. I wanted, you know, maybe a car with a therapist and some bottled water. I had some real issues I had to clear up, you know. And he said, I think you need to go to the meeting. And I went into that meeting. And this is what I came here to talk to you about. What's happened? You know, I try to describe this morning to you. Do you see the difference between this morning and all those years? Living like an animal, acting like an animal, almost killing an unborn child by accident. And now I got 31 days. I'm a little bit shaky. I just ran away from a party. And I go into this meeting and I didn't hear a thing, man. I heard wah, 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 wah. The speaker was dressed really beautifully, stood up to the podium, couldn't tell you what he said. I'm looking around at all you people. I feel so alone. And I got up to leave at the end of the meeting and this guy walks up and he says, hey, aren't you Neil's little brother? My brother who 12-stepped me. And I said, yeah. He said, can I give you a ride home? And I said, yeah, because I ran here, you know? And we went out into the parking lot and I didn't get in his car. And he said, what's wrong? And I said, I can't go home. I explained what was happening. Now, I'm about to tell you about the second step. I talked about the first step, but I'll tell you the second step was he said, hey, man, I could take you to your parents' house. And my perception of that was that cannot happen. My mother and father are in love with each other. They're 45 years married. Their loser son, fresh out of rehab with an illegitimate child, is not showing up on their porch tonight. My mom's dying of cancer. My dad's beside himself. I'm not going to be another burden on them. They're good people. It's going to be terrible for me. It's going to be humiliating for me. And I'm still thinking I'm a rock star. I played at CBGB's a year ago, and now I'm moving in with my mom and my dad after my first AA meeting. No way. And the guy dropped me off at my parents' house because wisely, you don't listen to newcomers. he didn't care at all what I thought of that. And he knew where my parents lived. You know why? Because he had a great AA group, my brother. And they knew my mother was dying and they came over and helped my dad paint the house. So he happened to know where my parents lived. Grace, it's all over the place. Or at least it is in my life. And he drove me to this, my parents' house, and I walked up there terrified. I don't want to go in there, man. I really don't want to go in there. It's scary in there. And I knock on the door and I look down at the floor, and my mom and my dad are from the Midwest. They're from Illinois. And they come to the door together. That's how they do it back there. And back then my mom was strapped to a giant oxygen tank. It's not like today where they have these little packets, but I just stood on that porch wanting to run away. And I looked down on the floor, and on that porch, there's a guitar pick with my name on it. And I have no idea why it was there. I hadn't been to that house in 7 months. And my mother and father were very fastidious. They clean, every very clean house. And I don't know why that guitar pick's there, but I think that was grace too, because I was so mesmerized by it, I didn't run away. I just stood there while for the 10 minutes it took my parents to come to the door. And when they opened the door, they were glad to see me. And I want to talk to you if you're in your first 6 months of sobriety. I told you what my perception was, how horrible it would be for me to show up on that porch. And the reality was my mother and my father were madly in love. They've been married for 45 years. My mother's dying of cancer and they're laying awake at night worrying about me. And I just walked right up to their house and said, can you help me? It couldn't have been more perfect. I have news for you. Your perception, if it's anything like mine, has very little to do with reality. And that's okay. Just let go, relax, let reality in. In fact, I can tell you one of the great gifts of AA is my circumstances do not dictate my happiness, because I'm on a spiritual path. And if my circumstances dictated my happiness, I'd be miserable every 5 minutes or every other day, right? But I was in the bondage of self still. And my mom and dad welcomed me in. They put me in my bedroom and I woke up afraid. I woke up early in the morning and thought, Jesus, I'm really at my parents' house. I'm 31. I got this baby. Like, what happened? I felt like Dorothy, like they landed the house on the wrong person. And I go out and my dad's sitting at the kitchen table and I got a meeting directory because coffee shop Jim, who gave me a ride home from my first meeting, gave me a meeting directory. And I walked up to my dad at breakfast and said, hey, there's a 7 a.m. meeting. Can I go to that? And he said, are you asking to borrow the car? And I said, yeah. And he goes, well, if you're going to a meeting, don't ever ask me that again. Just go to the meeting. Because he saw my brother. So I went to the meeting. And I just to get away from them because they made me squirrely. There's nothing wrong with them. They just made me nervous. And I went to you guys and I forgot how squirrely you made me. Like, it was terrible. I went into the meeting and thought, oh my God, this is where I'm hiding from the uncomfortable place. And you guys are all loving on each other and hugging each other. I feel more alone than I've ever felt in my life. I stood up and said, my name's Matthew, I'm an alcoholic. Then you wanted to talk to me, which freaked me out a little bit. And then I ran home to the car. I got the car, drove home, sat with my parents till I was freaked out. I couldn't stand being there. So I went to the noon meeting. And then I get home at 1:30 and hang out with them till dinner time. I go, I think there's a meeting tonight. And I went to 3 meetings a day and back to my parents' house just to get away from the uncomfortable places. And I'll tell you what happened. What step 2 means to me is within 3 months or so, something started to change. And that step says we came to believe there's a power greater than ourselves. Now, I want everyone to realize that's what it says. It doesn't say our sponsor read we agnostics at us until we surrendered to the idea. It doesn't say that. It says we came to believe. And all my sponsor ever did say was, "You are you willing to believe?" And what happened was one day I woke up and I couldn't wait to see my mom at breakfast. My frail mom, strapped to oxygen, who always smiled at me when I walked in the room. Couldn't wait to sit with her. Couldn't wait to hear what my dad was going to say that day. My dad's hilarious. Like, I felt all this love with them. And then I thought, oh, I better go to that 7 a.m. meeting because I think Bill's going to be there. And Bill's hilarious. And then there's girl Cheryl. That girl Cheryl always talks inappropriately about her sex life. I love it when Cheryl talks. I'm going to go to that meeting. And I just go there. And then I realize there's so much love in that room. And then I hang out afterwards. And then I go home. I have to get home pretty soon because I got to make lunch for my mom. I didn't even know it. And I came to believe. I didn't even know it. And I was restored to sanity. And then I took a third step on the floor of my sponsor's apartment, holding hands. He said, "We're going to get out and hold hands, kneeling on my floor." And I thought, no, we're not. That's crazy. I didn't know I asked Jeffrey Dahmer to be my sponsor, right? And I get down on my hands and knees with this guy, and I'm holding his hands. And he starts saying the third step prayer, and I say it after him. And then he gets this part, "Relieve me of the bondage of self." And I really heard that. I was like, really? Like, that could happen? Because I know what that feels like. I know when I walk into a room and I start putting you in a box. Oh, you're that type of person. I don't like you. You're okay, but don't talk to me. So I can walk across a damn room. That's the bondage of self. You know what the bondage of self looks like at an AA conference? Me sitting in the front row judging the speaker. And then I turn and look at the woman next to me, and she's looking up there smiling at him. One of us is in the bondage of self, and it's not her. I'm Mr. Critical, right? There's 10,000 ways I'm in the bondage of self. But one of the reasons I told you about the morning is because I haven't been so far today. I made coffee for my wife, meditated, talked to a friend. She picked out my clothes and sat down to talk to you. And I didn't lie. So I got up from that thing, and you know, it says, we, you know, we're powerless over alcohol and our life is unmanageable. And then in the third step, it kind of says, you're really never going to be the manager. And my experience in 27 years is I have not even been invited to apply for the management position of my life. They've never even said, could we see your resume? They're like, we are completely uninterested in how you want to do this. But every day for 27 years, I've been invited to participate in my life. And I went to my sponsor a few months later and I said, you know what? I'm really saying that prayer, relieve me of the bondage of self. And my sponsor smokes cigars and sits outside of the meeting. And he said, really? Why don't you relieve yourself of the bondage of self? Sometimes he acted like the Riddler. He'd say things like that. Like, you know, I'm like, what does that mean? Relieve myself. And he goes, why don't you just go do something nice for somebody and don't tell anybody? I thought, that doesn't sound like that interesting to me, but my sponsor's pretty wise. And I walk in and there's 100 men at the Hermosa Beach Monday Night Men's Stag. And what we say in the beginning, like a lot of people say, is there anybody visiting from out of town? And this guy says, I'm Kevin and I'm visiting from Australia. And I'm gonna be here once a month. And I looked across at him, he had a suit on, we don't wear suits to our meeting. And I thought, I'll remember that guy's name. In 30 days when he comes back, I'll go up and I'll welcome him back. And 30 days later, he came back. I almost forgot about him. But I ran across the room when I saw him. And I said, hey, you're Kevin. Welcome back to the most amazing Alcoholics Anonymous meeting in the world. You landed in the epicenter of recovery when you walked through that door a month ago. I'm so glad you found us. And he looked at me and said, you remembered my name. And I said, yeah, it must be hard traveling. And he said, come outside. And I was living at my parents' house. I was working a swing shift at a loading dock, the Daily Breeze newspaper, from midnight to 4 in the morning. And I was delivering packages for a little delivery company and going to all these meetings. And Kevin takes me outside. He goes, what do you do for a living? And I'm standing there and all my ego's there. You know, I've got 2 degrees. I played all over the world music. And I go, well, I stack newspapers on a loading dock and I deliver packages. And I'm very fulfilled, you know. And he said, I don't really know what you just said, but I'm vice president of this airline. Come see me. Come to my office. Wear a suit. and get your DMV printed out. I'll see you next Monday morning. So I went to his office. All I had was a black suit and brown hush puppy shoes. But when you're new enough in AA, you can convince yourself that no one will look at your shoes, right? Because they're all the shoes I got. I didn't really have an opportunity to go, like, money to buy other shoes. And I was a little, I didn't even know what this job was. But I put a suit on. I got my brown hush puppy shoes. I got my DMV printed out. It was about this thick. And I walk in. And he looks at me. I knock on the door of this airline in a beautiful office overlooking Century. And he looks at me and he laughs at my shoes. Like right away, he starts laughing. And I'm a little nervous. And then he introduces me to the human resources woman, who was apparently a goddess from Hawaii. She floated across the room to me. She was stunningly beautiful. And now I feel like I have giant clown shoes on, you know? And she looks at me and her face gets real tight. She was Asian. And sometimes Asian people get more polite when they're irritated with you. I found that out. And she got this tense smile. And she took me into this room and she didn't ask me a single question to interview me. She looked at my shoes. She looked at my resume. Okay, good. So she doesn't ask me any questions. She gets up, she leaves the room with my DMV report. And she goes into Kevin's office and Kevin says, he's not going to fly the goddamn planes. He's going to put people on them. And I hear him through the wall. And she comes back. He comes back in and says, she says, I guess we're going to hire you. And she couldn't believe it. They gave me a suit and they gave me money to clean the suit. I guess they did that for everybody. I thought they were taking pity on me. And they gave me this great job. And the reason I tell you that story is because just for one second, I thought about somebody else. I surrendered just a tiny bit and God came running at me. Said, hey, Matthew, you're starting to catch on. Here's a better job. But my experience with grace is that first you surrender, then you get the gift of grace, and then you get elevated into what I would think is a higher love. There's a higher spaciousness of love. I can't wait to see how much higher I'm going to get before I die. But when I was just a few years sober, I got this job. And I went to work and I was living with my mom and my dad and I'm going to meetings, I'm going to panels, I'm working my amends back, I'm paying all this money back that I owe, I'm starting to feel good about myself. On my way to work one day, I buy a brand new guitar, a Taylor single cutaway Dan Crary. If you play guitar, you are jealous of me now. Beautiful guitar. And I brought it into work and I realized, well, no one at work's gonna wanna see it because I got hired by the vice president and I don't drink and I don't chase the women here. I'm just trying to stay sober, you know? So they don't know what to make of me. And if I go home to my parents, they don't want to see the guitar because they think rock and roll was my downfall. But I love this thing. I mean, I can't get enough of it. I'm visiting it on my breaks and we're having little chats, you know, and it's sexy, this guitar. And I'm so excited. I want to share it with somebody. So I walked out to the bus stop, the employee bus stop at 10:30 at night. And the employee bus comes about 20 minute ride to the lot where we all park. And there's this woman standing next to me from British Airways. And I said, hey, can I show you this new guitar I just bought? And she apparently was British because she turns to me and she says, I don't look at strange men's guitars. And it's like really cute accent. And I'm a little taken aback by that. I'm like, okay, I'm not hitting on you. Get over yourself. I just want two eyes to look at my guitar. And we get on the bus and she's pushed against me. I think she thought she'd get on the bus and do a British, you know, walk away. But she's right against me. And I got this guitar and she has a book in her hand and I can tell she's nervous. And I've read the book. So it was Surprised by Joy, I think, by C.S. Lewis. It might've been Mere Christianity, but I read it. And I said, oh, I've read that book, just so she'll relax. And she goes, well, cut to the chase. Do you believe in God? And I said, well, yeah, God saved my life. And she got a little more nervous. Like, who's this guy? And then she said, well, I don't believe in God. I'm really just looking. So we go on the bus ride and we talk about this God thing. And I realize she's really pretty, like really beautiful. And I'm not nervous at all. And I haven't started lying to her. I haven't started saying, actually, I'm an astronaut. I just work at Qantas for my day job. You know, I just am being honest with her. And I feel very comfortable with her. And we get off the bus at the other end, and I asked her if she would like to have dinner with me. And she did not think so. She's like, oh yeah, look at my guitar. I've read that book. And really lit me up. Like, you shouldn't do that. I need to wait for this bus. And I just put my hand up and said, hey, no is the complete answer. And the reason I tell you this story is because I wasn't dirty and filthy inside anymore. I had some self-esteem. And I had enough wherewithal to say, no is the complete answer. You don't have to yell at me. And she walked away. And I was really sad that I hadn't made a better impression, because she seemed like something special. And I went home to my dad, who's crying at night because my mom of 50, now they ended up being married 50 years when my mother died. And I went in there and I'm talking to my dad and I'm trying to head him off at the pass. And I said to him, I met this girl and she felt like home. And he goes, really? And I said, yeah. He said, tell me about that. And I told him the story I told you. And he said, that's not over. And I said, that's over. And I went to work the next day. And I tried not to think about it, but I thought about it all the time. And then I saw she was at British Airways. So I knew I couldn't be on that bus. So I ran to get on the earlier bus. I finished up at 9:30 instead of 10. And she came up behind me and she tapped me on the shoulder. And she said, I think I was rude to you. I said, that's okay. And she said, I don't want to go out with you. And I said, you've been real, real clear about that. And she said, well, but maybe we could miss this bus and have some coffee. I said, okay. So we missed the bus and we missed all the buses. And we took a cab to our cars. And 17 days later, she proposed to me, and we've been married for 25 years. She's in the other room. I just saw her put her head in here. So why do I tell you this? Because it took an awful lot of relief from the bondage of self to attract someone the quality of that woman. It took an awful lot of relief from thinking just about me to become like almost turn myself inside out by doing what you told me to do, not thinking what I was, you know, I like to think and conceptualize. He said, go do it. Get in the car. Take people on panels. Pay all the money back. Do it. And Pip and I have had an incredible life. Incredible. We had two children ourselves. And you know who showed up at the hospital? Phoebe and Anna. Both times. They're waiting right outside for us, right? And I'm here to tell you, I didn't have to lie to her. I don't have to lie to Pip. I'm enough. You know, I'm so glad I don't manage my life. I'm so glad I get invited to participate in my life. You know, and I do the 12 step. They put my daughter, Sophie, she's 20 now. And in her college entrance essay, she said, where most dads pick up their daughters and take them to tea parties when they're in grade school, my dad picked me up and took me to ICU to visit Liver Mike. We got to visit Liver Mike. Where most dads built mother-in-law quarters above their garage for their kindly grandparents, we had Toothless Tim living in our trailer in our driveway. And this is her life, right? But we just did it. Sloppy love. You know, clumsy love. The way love is. And when Pip and I were married about 5 years, I came in. And I found her on the floor, and she'd had a massive stroke, and she's paralyzed now for 20 years. And she's very, she's amazing, but she's forgetful. She's not reliable. And we had a 1-year-old and a 4-year-old and an 8-year-old with Phoebe. And I'm here to tell you, our circumstances do not dictate our happiness. I think it's a privilege. Like, I used to lie and say, I've been her caregiver. She would laugh her ass off if I said that. What I do is I help her get dressed and I help her get undressed. And I remember important things. She is the caregiver. I do everything that it takes to do with two hands because she only has one hand. And we've had all the stuff everybody's ever had in marriage. We've had the great times and the bad times. We've had wonderful children, and we've checked one of our kids into a mental hospital for a while. And we've done it side by side. It was never a question of us against each other. It's always a question of us moving forward. And the reason what does this have to do with recovery if you're in 6 months? Every freaking thing. It says in the book, grow maximum service to God and our fellows. I didn't come here to practice to not go out on the field and play. And I got this amazing life. And I'll finish with this. I was going to start this talk by saying I've had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. I have a conscious contact with a power greater than myself that I call the timeless plentitude of being. But there's 560 people on this call, and I knew about 400 of you ago, oh, here we go with this Mr. Mystical spiritual awakening. I'm going to tune out for a while. Even in AA, we do that. But if I'd said to you, I have a beautiful home overlooking a valley in Santa Paula. It's 100 years old and it's amazing. I have 17 guitars. I have four lovely children. We adopted another one. Pip made me adopt one. We have four lovely children we've raised to adulthood. I have a great job I've been at for 15 years. You'd go, those are the gifts of recovery. No, they're not. No, they're not. That's the gift of not drinking. I imagine I'd have a wife in the other room if I didn't drink for 27 years, probably my fifth or sixth wife, but I got the same one, right? But what the gifts of recovery are is I have a sense of serenity like Todd talked about with Jenny. I have a sense of serenity when there's calamity around me. I have a sense of wisdom when my children come to me with problems I don't understand. I fall in love with people I don't even know. I do a lot of jail and prison work. And you walk in those places, they're dark. They're a little scary. There's a lot of mental illness in there. And I walk in there a little bit, you know, nervous. And I float home. And I'm thinking about somebody in there who might have a chance, who came up and asked me some questions, who still looks like he's a little off. And I pray for that guy. And I pray for him. And I don't even know him. And I come back the next month and I hope he's going to be there so I can talk to him some more, maybe give him a book. That's what it looks like. You want to know what a spiritual awakening looks like? Read the promises. We will lose interest in selfish things. You know, that's the gift of recovery. It's not that I have these things. It's that I walk among them present. It's that I'm unencumbered by my brain some of the time. You know, if you're not doing the 11 step, stop telling people you work the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a mental disease. It's selfishness and self-centeredness. Why not give yourself a break 20 minutes a day and just think about God? It's worked for me. I came here and I was an animal. I threw a woman down a flight of stairs and I didn't even care. And right now, honestly, I know Pip's in the other room. I can hear her. I can't wait to see her. I really like her. Thanks for letting me share.
Thank you for sharing, Matthew. My gosh, everybody, Matthew.